All lines are now bridged.
Thank you, and good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to another edition of our ICAT Task Force. Quick roll call, and we'll get started. Cheryl Kearney?
Here.
Alex Goss?
Present.
Erin Mary? That's okay. Abby Sears? Not yet. Okay. Alexis Snyder?
Here.
Andy Truscott? Emil Jane?
I'm here.
Harry Malik? Deb Strickland?
I'm here.
I believe we have Denise Webb?
Yep, I'm here.
And Gus Jarcy?
Here.
Jackie Monson?
Here.
Great. James Pentelis will be absent today. Jim Jorge? Jocelyn Keegan?
Here.
Great. Les Leonard? Mary Green? Ram Sriram?
I'm here.
Rich Landon? Sasha Termat? Hello. Steve Brown?
Yeah.
Great. Tom Mason?
I'm here.
And Carolyn Peterson? Okay. Handing it over to Alex and Cheryl.
Well, thank you so very much for doing that roll call today. We did get a separate note indicating that Mary Green will not likely be here today, but I think her backup, Alex Mungy, will be joining us shortly. We're also seeing a request as the call has been opened up to the public, and I think staff support, the answer is yes, but they're not hearing our audio. So I'm hesitant to start with the call until we...
Let me just double check with the operator that the lines have been bridged.
I'm hearing it's
yes,
been bridged.
Yes, all lines are bridged.
All right, so we're Lauren Wu, who can't hear me but might be able to read my words. I suggest that maybe she try to dial back in because everything is bridged and we're getting confirmation from other participants that they can hear us. Thank you. All right, so... good afternoon. This is Alex Goss. I'm going to kick us off with a bit of agenda review and giving us some level setting on the summary and action plan from the last meeting before turning it over to Cheryl to walk us through the data categories along with Josh Harvey, who's been very helpful in capturing a lot of our thoughts and advancing work between meetings and may showcase some additional thinking evolved from your thoughtful contributions at our last session. After talking about the data categories for a little bit, I'm going to jump into the guiding principles and ideal state tab. May ask Alexis Snyder if she's willing to help me co-facilitate that session as she added some very thoughtful comments into that tab today. And then we'll want to confirm our next steps and level set our thinking on where we want to head before we go to public comment and then adjourn ultimately today. With that overview, we're going to go ahead and jump into the summary and action plan. Thank you. So it's always good to start with a reflection of where we came from, and because even though it's only been a week, I don't know about you, but it's been a long week. A lot's been going on, a lot of holidays for folks, and some religious celebrations, and a lot of other activities pulling us away, unfortunately, due to COVID. But we were able to accomplish a number of things at the last meeting, including refining the data categories table. It really helped us to level set our thinking at the concept level and being mindful of not wanting to go too into the weeds. One of the things that we thought was particularly helpful in the last call was that right-sizing our expectations, and Cheryl and I spent some time talking about that after the call, and really were very appreciative of the sort of the mind meld we heard come from the task force message about staying at the right level. We also started to discuss some guiding principles, so we broke those into a separate table for us to start working and also added some additional tables to help us capturing kind of where we want to head in the end with potentially a report. So we've got one space with in Google Docs for the task force members to collaborate. Understand that some folks are still having challenges with getting into Google Docs, so please correspond with the ONC HITAC support that they will be able to guide you through reconciling any access issues that you may be encountering. In addition to our work on the table, we really got some volunteers to raise their hands to advance the information or data categories table, as well as what we're affectionately referring to as the Happy Path group that reflects our guiding principles and ideal state bookends. So we'll talk a little bit more about those today because we've had some content added. I really want to do a shout out to the comments that were captured in the last meeting and thank the team that got those comments translated from the last meeting into an other considerations tab, almost like a parking lot, so we don't lose those great thoughts. This really starts to give us a robust framework for us to capture our thoughts and then iteratively week by week advance them either between meetings or more especially during our 90 minutes together every Tuesday. In addition to that great work that we accomplished, we also are looking ahead and thinking about the show and tell of the current state and more especially the projects that are happening in the landscape today that can help to meet our the guiding principles and ideal state considerations that will be evolving. So we put that on the plate of consideration but realized we needed to do a little bit more work, but I think we want to talk about trying to do some advanced scheduling, so we'll get to that at the end of today's call. So if we could go to the next slide, please. So the approach for today is to hear back from the very informal subgroups that have been nibbling away at the data categories and the guiding principles and ideal state tabs in particular. Time permitting, we can start to look at the other considerations tab. But as we discuss things today, we're gonna rely upon Josh to give us some support in capturing the details of the best of our ability, and then ask folks to continue, regardless of whether you volunteered in the past. As task force members, we encourage all of you to update the workbook and considerations between meetings. After we do some of the work group or the tab reviews, we really want to talk about our next phase to continue to advance our efforts. Cheryl, would you like to add anything to the last meeting or today's meeting setup?
I think you did a great job, Alex, in explaining it. I know I was a little bit challenged when I put in most of the comments that were made in the last meeting in the other considerations, so we didn't lose those. I did not highlight them in yellow, though, because it wasn't new information in between the meeting that we would necessarily want to review, because all of that data was shared in the last meeting, and it's also in our meeting notes. But again, I and Alex did not want us to lose that, because this way we can use the workbook as our source as we're trying to draft our final paper, rather than having to hunt through all of the comments people have made along the way. But as we, Josh is going to open the document in a few minutes, and we're going to start looking at the data considerations tab, and then you can see how people have been making updates. And again, as Alex just said, you know, please be sure to go out there. If you have any trouble opening it, it's probably because you don't have a Gmail account linked to your work email address, and they can basically either open it or give you permissions with a Gmail account address that you might have, or add your work email address to it. So if we can get that resolved this week, that would be really, really good. But also, thank you to everybody who did participate from the last meeting, because we do have a lot of updates, which is going to be wonderful.
I think that's a perfect segue, Cheryl, to the next slide for review for you and Josh to take
hey,
us into the table.
Can you clean
it up?
I'm doing quite a bit.
Okay, thank you. I don't know. I think that was background conversation somebody had. All right, so Josh, if you could, all right, he's doing his screen share. So we'll just take a moment. And this is not yet in the Google update table because Josh and I believe Jocelyn did review it. So Josh is going to speak to it. But this was such a big change that we really wanted you guys to be able to see it before we make this change into the table. And this is based on the suggestions that folks had to further define the terms and also help to reorganize them because it might help people assimilate better, you know, what the data flow is that's going to help us drive some of the recommendations that we need to include in our paper. And I'll let you take it from there, Josh.
Sounds good. Thank you. So, yeah, so after last week's call, Dr. Jurgis and I were spending some time catching up and kind of bounced around some ideas about how to try to incorporate a lot of the common themes we were hearing on the call last week and try to kill as many birds with as few stones as possible. So I reached out to Cheryl and Alex in between meetings to say, hey, this is a little bit different, but I think I have a way to kind of restructure the kind of foremost parts of this, the inventorying of the data and helping to clarify what data we're talking about before we dive into the more granular parts. So it'll help us find the right balance between kind of more higher level concepts and then the more granular information we need in order to identify the current state and ideal state standards for each of the different data requirements we have. So fundamentally, the idea was essentially to piggyback off of the great work that ONC has done on version one of the US CDI and use this notion of data classes and data elements to help organize and separate those higher level concepts from those more granular, you know, data element types of information. So a lot of this has a direct overlap with the US CDI, making it pretty easy to fill out the remainder of the spreadsheet, assuming that we have agreement on, you know, that being the best approach forward. Some other things may be a little more difficult, but if we have kind of a framework for how to capture it, then that's where we can spend calories between meetings. So I'll just briefly go over this and open it up for feedback because for the most part, this is really just reorganization of information we've talked about before to hopefully make it a little more digestible and scalable as we go through and do the future steps. So just as a pretty basic example, the first data class that I think has kind of risen to the surface and is a little easier to digest than maybe some others is patient demographics. There's already a great foundation for that in ONC's version one of the US CDI. So the idea here would be to describe demographics as kind of a concept or a data class supported by several different more granular data elements, which I think everybody kind of follows from previous experience and other applications. Now expanding it beyond a more basic example than that, taking a stab at organizing some of the other pieces of information in the classes and elements. One of those being those things related to an insurance plan. So we've discussed payer, plan, and benefits information as all important data elements that would be associated with a payer and a beneficiary, some combination of the two. So the idea being that those things are interrelated, we could tie them to a data class and organize them that way so they could be then used in a more modular way, but we've described them as one broader concept. There's also several different kind of outstanding questions that I've started accumulating after going through this, where there may be some redundancies and some level of clarification that we might need in order to tie it to a particular standard. So I envision those as things that we can continue to add week to week in some of the comments kind of sections of the working document that we have. So I don't want to spend too much time kind of going through this, but I do want to just point out, I guess, the classes that I've listed out. So I mentioned the payer kind of information, but I think some really important ones are these ones related to the prior authorization requests and then the information going back and forth between the requester and then the approver of the request. So those have been broken out into what are effectively five classes, but I would classify this as a pretty rough idea that I think we're going to want a lot of feedback on. So the initial idea would be that there's a request and some basic information that has to be transmitted as part of that request, much of which is, you know, are things we've already discussed. And then there would be different information that would be included in a response from a payer back to the provider submitting the request. So that's where things like the coverage determination and or requirements to actually satisfy the request, you know, documentation needs and things like that could be transmitted. And then a further class that would include all of the information that would be included in a response back to the payer to support the request initially made once the requirements have been defined. The notion of a follow-up, so a request for additional information if there was something beyond what was already included in the justification that was necessary. And then ultimately a decision, so an approval or denial, and then all those things we talked about around the covered alternatives and cost of plan, cost of patient. And lastly, there is a class just broadly described as metadata, which I think you can make the argument that each of these classes may have its own metadata associated with it, or all of the metadata could be separated out in its own data class. So I think those are things that would continue to be up for discussion. But I'll stop there and see, I guess, first, I know Jocelyn, you've had an opportunity to review a little bit ahead of time. So if you have any feedback or input you want to share before we open things up to the rest of the group, I want to make sure you have an opportunity to do that.
Thanks, Jocelyn. Sorry, I didn't get back to you. As Alex said, it's been a crazy couple of weeks. So I think I really like the structure and the way that you simplified that, sort of the classes concept, I think is a really good way to look at this. I think that when I look at it, and I put a couple of notes in the chat, but when I look at it, we have this visual that we use that talks about sort of the steps to get through a prior authorization that's way more than just actually submitting a prior auth. And so I think that bucket around insurance plan is actually more complicated than just sort of who's your insurer. There's really a class of content that is around coverage. And coverage sort of cuts across, you know, what's the service you're asking for, who are the providers, and what are the different rules around particular, you know, groups of providers based on your contract. Are there any constraints around locations and where you can go based on your contract, right, that you have for that particular member with that particular payer and that particular provider? And then a concept around really co-pays, patient obligations. And so I think it's separate from just sort of who the insurer is, because that in itself is complicated because there's the, you know, sort of who having dual coverage. But I think that this concept of just coverage itself and coverage detail, in pharmacy world, it would be formulary and benefit. In the work that we're doing on the DaVinci side, it would really be the concept around coverage requirements, discovery, and documentation templates and rules would really answer those questions. And in some places, you know, based on our conversation we had last week, there are vendors and payers that do a really great job with having really rich, robust 271s, so that data can come out of a 271 today as well. And then the second area that I think that I would say that is in my, as I was looking at the classes, is really this concept of part of the challenge I think that we have with existing PA standards is what's this concept of sort of the payload of the clinical data itself that's often used to justify the decision. So that's in the PA justification area, but I almost think that there's sort of like the proof, sort of clinical information that may be beyond what's just in clinical notes. That could be lab results, it could be images. And so just this concept of sort of what is that clinical record? I don't know if it's just blowing out justification more or if it's its own class of data. Those are my immediate reactions looking at the structure. But I really liked it.
Thank you, Jocelyn. That was very helpful. We do.
And I'm looking at Raj's comment. Do you want me to talk a little bit about the DaVinci use cases and how these sort of fit in together? Or Raj, did that sort of get at what your question was?
Raj, I think Jocelyn was responding to your question in the chat.
He's typing.
Okay. I see it now.
Yeah, so, I can't share my screen, can I? So there's three use cases in the DaVinci world that we're working on that are really around creating transparency around benefits and where and if you need to, being able to automate the population of the data required to do the 278 transaction. So there's coverage requirements discovery, which is the ability leveraging CDS hooks to put in workflow a trigger to basically say, based on this thing I want to do for this particular patient at any given point in time, can I do this? Are there any blockers, things I need to do, boxes I need to check? We typically describe it as, is prior auth required? Really being able to answer that question definitively for the caregiver. And then if and when there's something that needs to be done, the next trigger, or the next sort of either smart app or call that could be triggered in workflow for a care team would be an implementation guide that we call document templates and coverage rules. And that was, if I need to do something, actually tell me what the rules are. Tell me what I need to document. Tell me what needs to be in the physical record to make sure that I'm going to get paid for the service I'm performing. And then tell me what the rules are so I can know whether or not I meet necessity, or tell me other information about this, you know, alternatives and information like that that would be available. And then if and when I decide as a caregiver, I actually want to do this thing, it requires some additional permission, like a prior authorization. How do I do that prior authorization as automated as possible? And so we have a third implementation guide that's called Prior Auth Support, which we've worked to essentially extract and collect the data in a FHIR, using FHIR resources from the EHR, and working with HL7 and X12 members, the members of DaVinci that are both HL7 and X12 members, we've actually done a crosswalk between the FHIR resources and the X12 278 standard so that we could potentially automate end-to-end. And we've had some members that have started to demonstration projects doing this, being able to go from EHR to FHIR to 278 to get a determination that then comes back to FHIR to fully automate the prior auth as part of workflow. And what I would say from an adoption standpoint is we're talking about having one of the early adopters come in and share their progress and sort of the decision points they've gone to. I've been talking to Alex and Sheila about that in the background. But what we're seeing is that typically people are sort of chomping on doing the CRD use case first, just really getting better information in front of that physician or the physician team about whether or not they need to do anything, and that in itself has a huge benefit just from reducing the complexity and the unknown in workflow for provider teams. Thanks, Alex.
That was really helpful. And we'll look to see if Raj has a follow-up question, but we definitely had discussed having that presented as in a future meeting so people would be aware of it. We also
that was totally Mountaintop, sorry.
That's okay. We also have a couple of other questions, and Arian is first, and then Alex Snyder. I don't know if they're particularly for you, Jocelyn, or for the greater table. So, Josh, maybe if you can re-show the table, that would be helpful as people ask their questions. Arian, why don't you go first?
Thank you. So first of all, want to comment that I've got two sets of issues relating to getting access to the document that I need to work through. One is that my data loss prevention framework around Change Healthcare doesn't even allow me to get access to Google Documents, so I've got to do it from my home computer. And then secondly, I've got the work email, personal email. So I'm working through some of that stuff so I can actually comment on the table directly, but apologies for not getting there yet. Really like the organization and framework. So first of all, just kudos to doing the hard work of reorganizing the table. Secondly, and I'm not sure if this has been an area that DaVinci has explored, but in previous work that I've done around complex multi-stakeholder orchestrated transactions, the notion of expressing the current state of workflow is really important. And then if you get super fancy, you can actually express some of these things as state machines. So what state can I transition to given that I'm in this state? But at a very simple level, just expressing the current, allowing someone to query the current state of a prior authorization or authorization request is a really useful lens. And some of the stuff that you've encapsulated as request response, additional information, et cetera, may be better captured as opening a prior authorization and then getting the current state and responding to the current state with appropriate information. In some cases, you go directly from request to approval. In many cases, you go from request to additional information needed, and then some of the edge cases, you get to denial and denial appeals and those kinds of things. So if you start to think about these things as what's the current state of my authorization, that may get you, that may be a useful unifying comment. So, and again, once I get access, I will go through and try to add some of the stuff on the table itself. Thank you.
Thank you, Arian. And I think that's very appropriate comment too about the statuses, because we definitely need to be sure that we're providing those, you know, in the table. All right, why don't we then go to Alex Snyder? Alexis, I'm sorry.
That's okay. I'm going to piggyback onto what was just said and maybe just expand upon it a little bit. So usually if you're dealing with a complex patient, and I mentioned this on another call, you're dealing with multiple insurance as well. And usually that second insurance is going to need a denial or partial approval or any of the approval before they will make their final decision about cost. So I can't see the table live now, but somewhere in that decision box needs to probably break it down into primary insurance, secondary insurance, because it's going to be like a different process for someone with single payer insurance. And then piggybacking on what was just said, the multiple providers in complex care that are usually involved in something like durable medical equipment, and more specifically a wheelchair or other apparatus, it's kind of a place on the table where that PA process started, reflecting who's running the show, basically. Who's collecting all the information when there's multiple players bringing pieces to the PA process, so that they don't get lost, and who's going to ultimately submit and translate it. So I'm not quite sure at the moment how we necessarily capture that easily in those boxes, but it's still something to remember that, you know, just as an example, you may go to your physical therapist who is saying, oh, you're going to need a wheelchair or crutches or what have you, but we need the prescription from your primary. Somebody has to start the PA process. It goes back to the PT to then, you know, write up there why it's needed and the functional status, et cetera, and things can get lost in the shuffle. And then there's your DME provider who's collecting it all as well. And so usually there's at least three people with hands in it,
And that's usually where things go wrong. So I don't know how we reflect multiple providers and the multiple insurance, but it's important to the process because that's where a lot goes wrong and creates a lot of extra work for the providers too when people might be doing things twice as well.
Yeah, I know in the original table we had the secondary insurer and probably would need in some cases tertiary because I know that at most people seem to have three. But right now, Josh, I think, has lost access to the Adobe meeting, so we can't show his table because it's offline. It's not in the Google Doc. So I apologize for that. But we will take that comment back and make sure that it is in there. But it was in the original. I'm looking at the original right now. There was definitely secondary was out there.
But it wasn't in the original. We added it when I mentioned it on a couple of weeks back's call. But it's important because you might get that first approval and then it's useless if you don't have it for the second.
No, I mean, it was in there last week. That's what I meant.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
The original one that Josh was working from, it's in there. So, any other questions or comments?
Hey, Cheryl, let's just check and see if Josh is back.
Hey, I am here, and I've been capturing those comments completely unaware that I was not still connected. So I apologize for that, but I am capturing the comments as I go, and I'm rejoining currently.
That's awesome. Thank you. I don't see any hands up, but I'm wondering, Gus Gerasi is making some comments, and I also saw Jocelyn make some comments in the chat box, which may or may not have gotten captured in that interesting conversation from Alexis building on Arian's feedback.
All right, so would either of you like to speak?
This is Gus. I just think there are some barriers to putting cost to plan and cost to patient in this kind of scenario, only because that may not be known until everything is done. And even so, I'm not sure that they would, and I can't speak necessarily for the insurer, but I've played with enough of them. They may not be willing to reveal that except in the EOB to the member, and then obviously the supplier knows what they're going to get paid, but I don't know that they would want the providers and all the other folks. But that gets to how granularly this information gets shared as well.
Yeah, I mean, I do know that that has been a concern that, payers and others have had, but even with the upcoming interoperability rule, when that's finalized, giving patients the ability to see what their costs are going to be with as much information as you have at that point in time is going to be a requirement. So I think it's something that, we don't want to leave out of this process.
No, I agree. And ultimately, the patient slash member should know ahead of time. But ultimately, yes, always finds out on the EOB. It's just, until that legislation or guidance or whatever is passed, that may be challenging for some insurers.
Exactly. That's a very good point, Gus. All right. I think there were a couple other people that made comments in the chat window. I do see Jocelyn has her hand up. So, Jocelyn, why don't you go first?
On the concept of price and sort of cost, we've spent some time on the DaVinci front on price-cost transparency. And then I also, with my Point of Care Partners hat on, there's been really actually positive progress around the concept of real-time benefit check as a transaction on the pharmacy side. And I think that there's probably two ways that I would sort of frame this up, because I completely agree with Gus's point that it's challenging to date. I think that if we think in terms of cost and that it not being maybe a specific dollar amount, but as the patient gets further through the journey, and there's more known, you move from sort of the initial, which is an answer to say, this person has a copay of X amount, this person has a, you know, a cost sharing of 20%. This person has a high deductible plan, like sort of that high level first pass at what is this patient's particular situation. So there could be a conversation around what the options are for that patient for their plan with their care team sort of at the very first step. And then as things become more known, which procedure, at which location, with which doctor, then you can get to a more fine-grained reality around what a specific cost would be. But all of those steps get you to better information that's not just about sort of what the options are with the unknown of someday I'm going to get an EOB to tell me how much I'm paying for something, which is how we all operate today, but being able to make informed decisions and give the patient choices as they start to look for care providers and be able to, I hate to use the word shop, but be able to make, you know, decisions about what their options are based on their actual health plan benefits. So I guess I look at part of this workflow needs to be including that information leading up to being able to get to, you know, a fully automated prior authorization.
Yeah, those are all really good points. And I think there were a couple of additional points being made while you were talking, Jocelyn, you know, in the chat window as well. And I don't know if those folks want to speak up, but let's go to Arian first, who rose his hand. Go ahead.
Thank you. And definitely appreciate the point that there are business considerations sometimes that prevent the flow of information, or there are considerations where you just don't have enough information to appropriately price. I think one of the benefits of modeling the happy path and modeling the end state is that we can model a state where not that everybody gets access to everybody's price sheet, but that the patient has prospective pricing information for the class of service, the specific class of service that's being rendered, and really appreciate the point that sometimes that may need to be progressive as more information is supplied. But, you know, one of the benefits here is that as we model a happy path and an end state, we can model from the perspective that the patient is getting to full and transparent pricing information, recognizing that as we get there, we need to solve for cases where that may not be fully known or, in some cases, for business reasons, not fully shared. And the poor patient only finds out how much their responsibility is after the fact on an EOB, which is unfortunately the current state for many of us. Thank you.
Thank you, Arian. Very helpful. All right, hold on. I'm trying to see. Alexis?
Yeah, I was just going to reiterate the piece about cost that, you know, I had been sitting in the chat while Jocelyn was talking, and she kind of said a lot of what I was going to say. But, you know, when we're talking about something like durable medical equipment, until you meet with the DME provider and pick out specifics and they get ready to process something, there's no way to determine the cost. But I think it's important to preliminarily know pieces like what is the range of cost. It's easy to say to someone, oh, well, this manual wheelchair may cost you $5,000 or anywhere between $3,000 and $5,000, and there's this deductible and your insurance is going to pay $70 and you have to pay $30. Going in with that preliminary information makes a huge difference up front, just to know what's going to be covered, what's not going to be covered, and what your responsibility of it. You don't need the exact number. You need to know those pieces, because then actually even offline, patients can be sometimes looking up pieces of equipment that they want, cost of medications, et cetera, and then be more aware what that end cost is going to be. And then the final end cost in there after their for a medication has gone through, or they've met with a DME provider, et cetera. But I think that's definitely something that still needs to stay there and start giving those preliminaries, especially for patients that aren't as savvy as knowing what the benefits are, so that they do know if they've met the deductible or not, if not, how much it is first, what their coinsurance is going to be, et cetera. It makes a big difference to some, if you hear oh, it's going to be covered 100%. Do you want to keep moving forward, or should we try to find an alternate route to get equipment or a different medication, et cetera? Or you're going to have a $3,000 deductible first, and then you're going to pay 20% of it, and the cost is approximately what have you, and do some math and figure out if that's going to work for you or not. So I think that definitely is a piece that needs to stay.
Yeah, I definitely agree. Josh, I don't know, because I hadn't seen it before today, but with the list that you're showing us right now, do you have costs still on there, or is that was a TBD for after this week? Oh, you still have it there. But you have cost to plan, cost to patient. And I think originally we had cost to first plan, cost to second plan, cost to patient. So, you know, we need to definitely expand that based on what we're hearing in the meeting today to allow for multiple plan costs, because there will be some in the event of secondary and tertiary. So I think that's excellent to bring back. I think I saw a few other comments in the chat that they're all revolving around the cost aspect. Was there any other comments that people wanted to make on any other type of data class?
So this is Alex, and so one of the things I'm thinking is that Rich Landon gave us a comment about patient cost field, and that's kind of a nice segue into the guiding principles discussion, but I also realized that folks have been having technical issues with accessing the Google Docs, and on top of it, we're changing the Google Docs, so maybe what we can do, since we're slated to pivot at 3:40, we can go ahead and make that shift over to the primary spreadsheet, knowing that Josh will upload this revised approach, which is really getting some fabulous feedback today, and we can then start to get people to comment on that. All task force members are invited to do so, and especially if we can get their access issues resolved. If they can't, then I think we're going to have to maybe think about the way to download it, maybe send offline to help those who cannot work through their technical issues. So one of the things that Rich Landon noted was that the patient cost field is important to build in, and matching along with the lines of the discussion, it's a complex issue. We need to kind of think about where we're at today and where we can get to tomorrow. And so the point that I really liked about Rich's comment was that it was about the basic ability to capture and transport should be built in from the get-go, and that felt very much to me like a guiding principle. Since we only have stuff in column A, maybe we can make this a little bit bigger. And Alexis Snyder, are you still out there? And I know you did a lot of additions today that you put in yellow under the guiding principles, and all the other ones above your AKJ, I think that was...
It's me, Anil.
Anil did it. Okay, I'm confusing initials. I was like, wait a minute, AS is not AKJ. So Anil, would you like to talk about the ones that you added today? I apologize for
I'm happy
that
to,
up.
But I don't know if it's just me, but I don't see anything on the screen. It's all black. I can pull up the Google Docs on a separate browser.
Tom,
and,
I can actually see he's displaying the guiding principle.
Okay,
so
it's probably me. It's probably me. So yeah. I will pull up the spreadsheet on my computer, the live version of it, and I put a few things under the guiding principles. And I'll just read them out, and you guys tell me if you want more detail. Most of them. So when I thought about guiding principles, one of the things that I was thinking through is what do we want to make sure that whatever we recommend as a committee or as a task force, that we sort of live with those principles as a way to inform the level of depth and the amount of guardrails that we use in our recommendations. So I started with just establishing something that we've said in our meetings all along, is that perfection in every scenario is not possible. So let's go for being good enough or great enough, covering the vast majority of use cases. And I think that's really important. Even if you look at e-prescribing, there are exceptions to e-prescribing that we get as a clinician that I deal with when it's not appropriate. So even though we will do, you know, recommend this is the ideal state or the happy path for the vast majority, we need to have some room for some wiggle room so that we don't need to be perfect. The second one I put on here is that the approach that we recommend as a task force should be sensitive to the clinician burden so that we drive adoption and obtain the desired results. We could have a very patient-centric mechanism that's heavily automated, but if it adds any level or significantly more complexity to the clinical workflow or to the clinician's team, then you're likely not going to get adoption, and therefore we're not going to get the results that we want. And then I'll pause after I read them all, and we can go back to them. And I still can't see the document. Oh, I see it now. The third one is that our work should inform the coordination and alignment of existing efforts in the industry rather than reinvent them. And I think, again, one of the things that we don't want to do is have this task force come up with a whole bunch of recommendations for things that are already in flight, and rather we may want to recommend how they could be aligned with disparate efforts or perhaps not necessarily vote for or advocate for, but call out efforts that might be further along than others. And obviously we've talked about a lot of those in this task force meetings already. The fourth one is that something that I heard on a prior meeting, and I may have misunderstood, but we do need to make sure that the patient-centric view around privacy and security is not compromised in the hopes of making the PA process more efficient. We don't want to share more information with somebody than what is absolutely minimally necessary, and that's really difficult to do, but we need to make sure we don't sacrifice the privacy and security aspects, because it's simpler to send a packet of data or, the data classes are filled and we send them to everyone that it goes to, but really we need to really think about what is the minimum needed for that to work, not what is the easiest for that to work. And then the final one I put under guiding principles is that, there's a lot that goes into PA, and as a physician, I will tell you that I don't agree with a lot of the decisions that come back or the principles in which the folks may decide that my clinical opinion is not worth more than a set of guidelines that are adopted from 5 years ago or 10 years ago. But our work in this committee or this task force should be focused on HIT and informatics aspects, standards aspects, messaging aspects, interoperability aspects, rather than the thornier issues of trying to figure out why something is covered, why something isn't covered, using anecdotes to guide our discussions, fine, but using them to decide where we're going to carve out and carve in various policy implications is way out of scope. And our goal really should be to say, we're going to make whatever our society creates, we're going to make it more efficient, faster, and more transparent through interoperable standards and through HIT, than try to reinvent why I have to fill out a form every time I order X, Y, and Z. So I'll pause there. I hope those made sense, but I think what I was trying to do was to say that, you know, what should we be thinking about whenever we put something forth without going into the details of how each and every aspect work, because I think that's the goal for the first tab or the first sheet in terms of how we're looking at data.
Anil, that's a really great recap. It does. I had read the commentary before, or the entries 9 through 13 before, but the way you described it really brought it all home. And you got to hear from in the chat box from Jim. So it seems to be resonating from folks. And from just a process perspective, what I'm hoping we can do is have people talk about what they're adding to the table. If folks have concerns or tweaks or commentary, then please raise your hand or add a chat box. And so I'm not seeing any raised hands, so I'm taking that sort of as you know, no raised hands and no comments other than here, here is endorsement for what you've added. And certainly want to solicit people to raise their hand, add comments, or come in and update the table later. But these are all really good additions. From a guiding principle perspective, Anil, I want to see if Alexis had anything here, because I don't want to go down to the ideal state section until we kind of cover the guiding principles, if that's okay.
Yeah.
I don't have anything to add there. I would ditto everything that he said, and kudos for the worrying about the privacy piece.
And so the only thing that I'm wondering if we need to add, Rich Landon, the concept of the guiding principle is price transparency will be built in from the beginning. I mean, is that sort of one that we want to add to this? If you're talking, you're on mute.
Well, this is Anil. I mean, I think we should add it, but, you know, as a clinician, I will, and I'll let others weigh in. I will say that price transparency at the time of discussing with the patient on what needs to be done is a double-edged sword in many ways, because sometimes knowing the price may prohibit a patient from doing something about it. So until we get to a level of an ideal state when it comes to transparency of price, I find it very difficult to have a conversation with the patient, and the folks on the call who might have more patient care than I do these days may want to comment. But so oftentimes, you know, dollar sign, $2 sign, $3 signs is much more effective than specific amounts that may or may not change after the results come in and after the procedure is done. So, I think we should add something about price transparency, but I think because that's a moving target, waiting for that to be there from the beginning would mean that we would never get started until that all happens. And that may not be possible.
Rich?
Yeah, I think our principle, guiding principle number one, is putting the patient at the center. To me, that encompasses the concept of, you know, price transparency, because obviously the patient needs the best information available, you know, when making decisions for himself or herself. That being said, for reasons we've gone over, it's not always possible to know the exact price, and depending on other things that are dynamically happening, other medical expenses incurred, unforeseen situations in an OR, you know, it can change over time. But it's got to be built in, it's got to be acknowledged, and it's got to be a commitment to the patient. We have to set this model up to make sure business is done, but we have to do it in a fashion that absolutely enables the patient to get the information and to understand that decisions are being made and by whom. But it also is very clear, like what somebody said earlier, it is not our role to shape those decisions. That's up to whatever the process in place is and who owns that accountability and responsibility. That's not ours. We provide the information necessary for the actors to make the decision, but we don't attempt to influence whether something's covered or not, you know, based on our, you know, our own personal interpretations of what is right and just. Thanks.
Thank you for that. Jocelyn?
I think it might be helpful to understand the impact of what the real-time benefit check has been in the market for about a year and a half or so across some proprietary solutions. So I think when we have people come in to talk to us about EPA, the pharmacy prior auth automation, it would be helpful to understand the impact that data has had in improving the quality of that data over existing formulary and benefit data around prescribing decisions and sort of adherence to formulary. Because what we found from a research perspective is just getting better data allows that conversation to happen when the client, when the member is actually, you know, in front, the patient's in front of their doc. They can actually have a dialogue about what their options are. That changes it versus it happening asynchronously when the patient shows up at the pharmacy and gets sticker shock. So I think that, to me, having the placeholder for it and knowing that that's an important part of the step, that transparency information at care is important, But I agree, you know, we want to figure out what are the steps and then how are we sewing these things together based on current state to move in the right direction. I don't think it should be a blocker for us by any means.
Thank you. Anil? Anil, I'm not able to hear you.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Sorry about that again.
No worries.
I was saying that I think the principles ought to be built in right from the beginning, as Rich and Alexa said. But I do want to make sure we differentiate between what I think is, you know, it's a great service to know how much a patient might be paying for a specific drug. And it's generally very, very close in the ballpark when they actually go pick it up. But something as commonly done as a colonoscopy, I might know what an approximate cost would be, but that charge for that colonoscopy will vary significantly after the colonoscopy is done based on what is found and what might happen with the patient. And so we do have to differentiate between the different types of things that might be done to a patient and accept a certain degree of knowing, of thinking of price transparency differently for different types of services. And as long as we do that, I think it makes a lot of sense to create the capabilities up front, not let it slow us down, but make sure that we educate our consumer / patient, have them come along on the journey with us, because it is sometimes as nebulous for the clinicians as it is for the patient. Sometimes it's because we don't know until after the results are in, if a biopsy was taken, not taken, et cetera. So I just want to put that out there that, yes, but this might take a little while for us to get comfortable and the goals that we're trying to achieve around transparency.
Thank you for that. Alexis, I noticed you had a chat box that unfortunately Josh can't see when he's sharing his screen. He can't see any of the chat boxes. So if you would like to, I'm not sure if you're still going to propose that idea, but I would like to read it to Josh so to make sure he captures it or make sure it gets captured as a part of what other comments you may have.
Sure. I had raised my hand, so you don't have to read it if you want. I'll just kind of go through it with what I was thinking.
That's exactly. That's what
so
I would like to. Thank you.
Yeah, no problem. So the first piece I would say in reference to the comment that Josh can't see was I was saying under the patient-centered, patient at the center piece, we probably, besides the price transparency or cost transparency, add a piece about lessening the patient burden and the go-between for the patient being the communicator between multiple providers and trying to gather the pieces needed and check on where it is in the process and make sure that things are moving along, because that's very burdensome. And I think that's an important piece we shouldn't lose sight of. There's definitely a lot of patient/caregiver burden in this entire process. The other piece that I wanted to mention, and not to go on and on too much, the price transparency, but I think, I'm not sure if it was someone else at this point had mentioned not having the actual cost, but perhaps putting a dollar sign, like a $1 sign, $2 signs, $3 signs. I don't think that really works, something like that, because what is that? What is that range of cost? And every patient is different and there are different socioeconomic classes. And what might be two for somebody might be five for somebody else, dollar signs. I don't think that really is transparent enough. But again, I think it goes back to the point that I and others had made before about gathering 10 upfront about deductible insurance and a range of prices. And just for a quick couple of examples that I had thought of and jotted down while I was listening, in reference to drugs, there's a difference between finding out what the cost is for 30 days versus 90 days, mail order versus picking it up at the pharmacy. There's so much variable that goes into it. So as much information up front makes a difference in the end. Something else, another example I had thought of, something like getting an MRI, where you get it makes a big difference. So you do need transparency, knowing up front that it's going to cost, may cost you way more versus the outpatient MRI center, or to even call the MRI center because your insurance won't cover it there. So there's definitely those pieces there that should be transparent up front. Again, not the actual end cost. And then the other piece that I wanted to add to the conversation about where our recommendations should be and what we should focus on. Absolutely, we're not here to try to change the way the insurance companies are setting guidelines for how they're denying things or how they're approving things. But I want to make sure that we do not lose sight that part of the work that we are doing with the IT piece is to make sure that things get done seamlessly and that things don't get lost. And that's where I think we have an important piece to play here in making sure that the information is captured upfront and delivered to the insurance companies at the right points and the right information that they're looking for, so that that might make the difference in the end between an approval and a denial. Because just missing one little step or one piece of information they're looking for might just generate an automatic denial. And then that's just more work for the providers over again. So I just want to make sure we don't lose sight of that. I think those were all my comments in this area.
Okay, so for that third, so I think I was tracking with all three of those, and I think we've captured the concepts, except I don't know that we got the third concept, which is seamless and transparent information exchange and not letting it get lost, leading to a denial unintentionally. Do you feel
that
like it's captured?
I need to be. Yeah, I mean, it didn't necessarily need to be captured there. It was kind of more of a piggyback comment on just the larger conversation that folks were having about making sure we stay focused in a certain area. And I was just saying that, of course, we're not going to focus on fixing the insurance guidelines, but we do need to fix this process so that we don't end up with a denial in the end because we missed a piece of it.
Thank you for clarifying that for me. Okay, so I see that we've got Jim and then Anil with their hands up.
Yeah, hey, it's Jim. Just an important point to clarify about the discussions about the $1 versus $2 versus $3 sides versus what the actual copay is. One thing to consider is that they're really solving two different problems. One is when a provider is trying to, with a patient in front of them or not, decide between two sort of relative costs for the plan interventions, the cost of a cardiac MRI versus echo, for example. Having directional information about relative costs that the dollar signs kind of are meant to depict is valuable. The patient, however, may have a completely different set of needs, wanting to know exactly how much out of pocket. And I would say that it wouldn't be an either or, but both of them have value to managing costs, and both of them fit into transparency, but for different purposes.
Okay. Looks like we're adding a note there. Okay. Do you want us to capture something else, or it's sort of a commentary?
No, I think.
Sort
of... Well, there was a discussion someone brought up earlier, having relative costs, and then someone I think it was Jocelyn just said, well, that's not helpful. What people really want is out of pocket. So just in that cost piece, I think. There's different costs, and both approaches are valid. Not just, the relative cost of the dollar signs presented to the doctor isn't as valuable as the actual copay to the patient. I'm just making the point that costs should be depicted based on different decision. The patient wanting to know copay versus the doctor making a decision about general courses of treatment.
I think that that's important. This is Jocelyn. So in our pre-working sessions we've done sort of conceptually around price cost transparency, we definitely have gotten into that nuance. And I think as you shift into at-risk contracting, that cost to the provider organization actually becomes a really important information that the provider team is going to want to understand. I think that at the sort of gross grain level, understanding patient obligation is definitely sort of the first step. But I completely agree. Understanding sort of the different components of what essentially is a formula is important as all of the stakeholders get, you know, sort of better armed around, you know, moving into at-risk contracting and value-based care contracting. So, and we're all headed there, so.
Interesting. Anil?
Yeah, so Jim said exactly what I was trying to say, is that when I mentioned the dollar signs, yes, every patient's at a different point. It means different things. The dollar signs was for the clinicians. who are having to make clinical decision support decisions based on two, let's just say, bioequivalent or two equivalent imaging studies in the example that Jim gave. This happens all the time, and oftentimes clinicians are making decisions without really understanding the full impact. So the dollar signs is a clinical decision support aid, and that actually can lead to a much more meaningful conversation with the patient so that you can even get to the point where you start wondering what the copay is for an ultrasound of the kidney instead of a, for example, a CT scan of the kidney looking for a stone. So I think Jim said it well. The dollar signs is a clinical decision support aid. If that's not part of the EPA process and we have a divorced system between EPA and clinical decision support, we'll have other problems. So there ought to be some way of linking the two. If we have information about relative costs of equivalent testing, then there's no reason why that couldn't be incorporated into the clinical workflow at the same time. Otherwise, you could end up having some very strange decisions where a patient will know exactly how expensive their MRI is, but not realize the clinician could have ordered a simple X-ray instead.
Thank you. That's helpful. Jocelyn?
I'd like to double down, I think, on this point. I think it's really important that, you know, what we need to do from a focus perspective is bring together these disparate transaction sets, right, the HIPAA world to the clinical world. And that has to be part of our focus, is bringing those two disparate sets of information together and merging them, because it's critical in order for us to be, and Alex gets to listen to me talk about this on the Da Vinci front all the time, it's critical that we bring back together administrative and clinical transactions in order for providers and patients and payers to be successful in transforming how we care for people, right? So we can really focus on better outcomes. And I know that it's future state, but I think keeping that in mind as we move forward is critically important, because it's a world that's been divorced, you know, really for the last 30 years and 40 years, and we need to bring them back together.
Perfect segue. Thank you, Jocelyn. Let's go down to the next portion of this tab. It's called Ideal State, and if Josh could scroll down, I would be gratefully appreciative, and we'll have an ability to, I want to say to Alexis, if you had content you added, do you want to maybe talk to that? I know I put mine in yellow highlighting with my initials, and I think Anil did as well, so maybe you can kick us off to talk about a few of the Ideal State contents.
Well, I would if I could see it. I lost
okay,
my connection. I keep trying to log back in, but I mean, I do know the gist of what I put in there. What I tried to do under the and you can read off some of the specifics that I can't see.
Did you know if you added it below mine? Let me see if he can scroll down, because I can see the screen.
I added it, well, mine's not in yellow, and I added it right under ideal state where it said patient.
Yeah, so it's actually, you are at the top of the
page.
Of,
yeah, so I kind of made like a flow chart, more of a list of steps that ideally from a patient caregiver perspective would need to happen, you know, regardless of what's going on behind the scenes, that from our side and the coordination that needs to go into it, what happens walking into the office, getting a recommendation, finding out if a PA is needed, once the PA is needed, et cetera. So if you could see the list there, and if you have questions, I can specifically answer. And then what I did a little bit down was put in, I think you had started a tab that said patient visits ER. And there wasn't anything under it, and so I wasn't sure if you were looking for patient perspective, patient caregiver perspective on what happens and the happy path for the patient when they're in the ER. And so the only piece I added there was very minimally that hopefully it's an expedited process and you just get what you need while you're there. And then I had added a tab or a line for pharmacy. And I can answer any questions that are there, but the basics of, from again, the patient caregiver side of what is your happy path to getting the drug that requires a prior authorization. So again, you know, while you're reading it, 'cause I can't get logged in, just ask questions.
Yeah. Yeah, we seem to be having a number of issues with Adobe today, so and it's kind of sporadic. But
of
what
course,
we do
I
show
had
on
no
the screen.
Problems. The whole half, first half of the call until you asked me to look at it.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that you took the time to add patient visit, ER visit, and pharmacy, some high-level workflow steps of sort of this how should it work. I think that's a really great setup, and knowing that we are about 8 minutes away from public comment, I'd ask if Josh could scroll down to row 36. Because what I wanted, so if you bring 36 to the top of the screen, what you're going to find is several rows, so 36 to 45. I have extracted items. I was looking at the compendium of materials and thinking about the fact that industry has done a tremendous amount of work already on prior authorization, and I went through specifically the Weedy white paper and captured a variety of ideal sort of state policies, like concepts. Out of that, it took them and kind of either lock, stock, and barrel, or I tweaked them to fit into the spreadsheet so that we could have sort of this foundation of work from the industry, because the Weedy white paper also built on the coalition of the AMA and AHA and BCBSA and AHIP, I think, and MGMA. There was a consensus paper that came out, positions in January 2018, which were also included in the Weedy white paper, and I thought those were really good, and I didn't want to lose that basis of historical hard work by the industry, and so I'm going to cut it short on going through those, since many of us have seen those before, and I'm hoping that we'll take a deeper dive into some work on this tab. But there is additional content below, starting on row 46, if you could scroll down to that. Anil, I'd like to give you, ask you if you'd be willing to talk through the 46 through 49, which were new content that you added in and hadn't been prior artifacts that people would be aware of. And I want to spend the last
sure.
few minutes that we have going through those. Thank you.
Yeah, sure. I'll go through them fairly quick and see if there's any questions or concerns. I think the first one on row 46 is simply to say that that if we can, in the vast majority of cases, have everything automatically adjudicated so that the workflow and the relationship between the patient and their physician is that whole process is not interrupted for the vast majority of cases, that would be great. Oftentimes, what I've seen in the EMR world is that even workflows that can be fully automated still require a bunch of things to happen, and it just gets in the way for really low-value work that gets added to the process. So in the ideal state, we should try to automate with complete adjudication as much as we can, knowing that there are going to be situations, obviously, where more information is needed. And then the row 47, regardless of the venue of care, the PA process that we're going to recommend should look mechanically similar no matter where you are, whether you're an ER doc, whether you're happen to be seeing patients in urgent clinic that day, if you're a surgeon or if you're an anesthesiologist, if you're a rehab doc or you're a primary care doc, it should look very similar because the roles change and the patients travel to various places in the health ecosystem, and we don't want multiple ways of doing the same thing just because different people worked on it from their specialty vantage point. In an ideal state, in row 48, a full audit trail should be available to both the patient and the clinician with some lay-friendly language for the patient, obviously, but so that we have a common source of truth. Oftentimes, what I've seen, at least both as a clinician, but also in my own personal care whenever I've been dealing with this, is often the material I get as a patient is not aligned to the material that my physician will get and vice versa. And that just creates more friction and confusion and mistrust that we don't need in the industry. And the final one is that any workflow that's utilized to support the PA should auto-generate content that can be edited by the clinicians to document what it is that they just did. Oftentimes what I've seen in the electronic health record, whether it's a smoking cessation widget, for example, or something that is mandated as part of my interactions with the patient is that I'll do everything that the EMR has created, but and I'll go through all the steps, but I still have to now do a separate documentation of it when I just did all that. And the system could generate that content for me and say, okay, you just ordered a wheelchair because this patient has X, Y, and Z, and you've documented that they need it for at least 90 days, and you know it spits it out, and I simply have to just attest that that's the right information. We need to make things easier for the patient and the provider, not create more and more places where documentation is needed. So the ideal state should be automatically generated content. Now, I'll pause there. Again, this may not make sense to everyone, but I was sort of trying to come up with some things that we should be considering.
This is great. I'm really appreciative, and you've gotten a comment from Rich Landon for row 48. Can it be footnoted to capture the point made earlier that the physician provider should be able to use this process to ballpark the patient out-of-pocket costs of alternative treatments like the x-ray versus MRI example ahead of the patient visit so that the provider can discuss options already having an informed basis of cost alternative treatments?
Yeah, so, well, this is Anil. I mean, I think it's a great point. Rich, you want to expand on that? Sorry.
I fat fingered the number. It should be row 46.
Oh, okay. I read it because Josh can't see any of the comments, so I want to make sure we capture it.
I'll just say one quick comment. Most clinicians that I work with and when I practice part-time, I don't know how much time we have to spend with the information before we see a patient. I would love to get other people's thoughts, but I think if we had the luxury of being able to get that kind of information prior to the visit, that'd be awesome. But I think most of the time we're spending that time in the office with the patient trying to figure some of this stuff out. So I'll just leave it at that. But I think it's a great idea.
Yeah, and I also struggle with the fact that you get into the visit for a lot of them, and you don't know what you're necessarily going to need. If it's a chronic condition and you're kind of you're there on a regular basis, there might be a better indication of
right.
where you're headed. But it's kind of hard because sometimes you just don't know till you get there. You think it's one thing, and it's actually something else. So I'm seeing Rich, your hand went up, but is it on the same topic or a different one? Because I'm not sure how to cue you up.
Yes, continuing on the same topic. The thought is that we're two thoughts actually. We're talking about an ideal state, so having the availability or the ability to do that would be fine. That's the only understanding alternatives before. And second observation, it doesn't necessarily have to be the provider himself or herself. In most large organizations, there are staff that can be assigned to handle that function. If the organization chooses to make that investment. That's it.
Yeah. So thank you for that. Jocelyn was chiming in and saying this is key. I didn't know if you had an additional comment because we need to pivot to public comments. So if you could bring us home, Jocelyn. And thanks to Josh for being our savior in typing today. And so as Jocelyn gives us some final comments, if she has any, I think that we're going to pivot back to Lauren in public comments slides.
I think this is a great segue, Alex, to get back to, what is current state and what happens today. Docs don't do PAs, right? There's staff, there's nurses, depending on the organization. Maybe there's, support staff that actually queues it up. I think that when we think about sort of lessening the burden and improving automation, it's about what can you do in real time and that is automated and that is about getting better information. I think it was Anil that was speaking about, in an ideal world, you could see all that information at a glance. We get that a little bit in pharmacy today, right? And real-time benefit check is making that better so you can have a real conversation with your patient. But if and when a PA needs to be done, generally it's turfed off to staff. And I think being able to build tools where it can be automated and it becomes seamless and nobody even understands that a PA is happening behind the scenes, that's the ideal state. But if and when there needs to be review and content collected and curated, for prior auth, we need to acknowledge that work is being done by generally the nursing staff and not by an actual provider. Providers have such limited time with patients, they're not going to stop to walk through a questionnaire, you know, while they've got somebody in an exam room with them. And I think that if we keep that in mind and we keep that patient-centered focus in mind, then the rest of our decisions, I think, get easier about what's pragmatically going to help us make progress here.
So I'd like you to hold on to that thought and think about, while we go to public comment, what that might mean for our next steps and thinking about the current state sort of, or the demonstrations or the engaging with some industry experts to expand our thinking around things. And we'll come back to that as a part of the agenda item of next steps, which Cheryl and I will bring home after we defer to public comment. Lauren?
Thanks, Alex. Operator, can we open the line?
Yes, thank you. If you would like to make a public comment, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. A confirmation tone will indicate your line is in the queue. You may press star 2 if you would like to remove your comment from the queue. And for participants using speaker equipment, it may be necessary to pick up your handset before pressing the star keys. Our first comment is from Heather McComas with Greer Medical Group. Please proceed.
Hi there. This is Heather McComas from the American Medical Association. Can you hear me okay?
We can, Heather. Welcome.
Great. Thanks so much. First of all, I just want to express our appreciation for the task force efforts thus far. Unfortunately, I think during our public health emergency, the importance of your work is really highlighted to reduce administrative burdens for clinicians so that they can focus on patient care. As I'm sure you're aware, the AMA's places a high priority on reforming prior authorization. We've done extensive research on how this process can impact both patients and physician practices. Alex, as you referenced just a few minutes ago, we partnered with other national health care professional organizations and health insurance trade organizations in early 2018 to release a consensus statement that outlined key prior authorization improvements, and we regularly participate in standards development organizations that are involved in creating transactions for electronic prior authorization. So we'd first just like to offer assistance to the group at any time, and please consider that a standing offer. This is obviously a huge priority for us. So please consider that a, you know, put out the bat signal and we'll be there to help out. For now, we just like to offer two basic comments. The first is more of an observation and the second is a suggestion. We've observed that the task group has been using the term delight often throughout its discussions to date, and we really appreciate your enthusiasm and your optimism, but we have to stress that prioritization in its current state is anything but delightful for patients or physicians. In our 2018 prioritization physician survey, over a quarter of physicians indicated that prioritization has led to a serious adverse event for a patient and their care. And I also think about many of the stories that are found on our fixed prioritization website. One particularly comes to mind from a patient. The patient wrote, "I was diagnosed with Crohn's disease. The medicine my doctor prescribed required prior authorization. While waiting for the appeal, my colon perforated. I received my approval later the day I had emergency surgery to remove my colon." So obviously that's just a devastating consequence for that patient. And our survey data and the story highlight the magnitude of the current problem and the urgency of moving industry towards viable solutions. So we encourage the task force to review our survey results and identify how your efforts will resolve the direct impact on both patients and clinicians. We've also noticed that the task force has identified many important issues to tackle, and we appreciate the fact that you've kind of taken a sky is the limit approach to your work. However, we have to note the fact that you do have a deadline of September, unless that's been changed. And so because of that looming deadline, we encourage you to perhaps think about limiting the scope of your work so that you will have meaningful, actionable recommendations in that limited time frame. Here's some things to maybe think about in terms of scope. Where is the standards guidance for prior authorization most desperately needed? As you've been talking about, there is a standard for prescription drug prior authorization and CPDP EPA transactions, and that transaction is accepted in the industry. It was named in an NPRM last year. However, in contrast, as you all have discussed multiple times, the X12-278 transaction has very low adoption, and there is currently not a standard to exchange clinical data. So it seems to us that perhaps focusing on medical services prior authorization might be something to consider. We also would ask you to think about if you are thinking about issues and trying to solve things outside of prior authorization. We've noticed that there's a lot of discussion about price transparency and patient costs, and we fully agree that these are critical issues and they can very much impact a patient's ability to access care. However, we would argue that they may involve different processes or transactions, such as real-time adjudication or predeterminations that might be outside of prior authorization workflows and processes. And then we'd also, and I think this has come up maybe a little bit just a couple minutes ago, but think about what information and work has already been done in the industry. Things like, again, the 2018 consensus statement that represents an agreement between both providers and health plans on key prior authorization reforms. Also, we think about the Da Vinci Clinical Advisory Council guiding principles that were developed, and they address many of the privacy and security concerns that the task force has addressed, and we encourage you to take a look at those and incorporate those in your work. But there are many things that we don't know right now. For example, could the 278 transaction work with an attachment mandate? What are the costs and benefits of the various standard approaches, whether it's X12-278 and attachment versus FHIR? Do we need pilots? It seems like these would be really important data points for you and things that we haven't, other groups haven't done yet to date. We encourage the task force
Heather,
to focus
really
on...
this is really important input, and I want to make sure we get all of these thoughts. We do have another commenter in the queue with only
okay.
2 minutes left in the meeting. Could there be an ability for us, because I think you might have written these up because they're extraordinarily thoughtful and detailed. Could we get a copy of this? Because I think you started to go in like when from the Da Vinci CAC guiding principles on some very actionable things we might want to consider. Can we correspond?
Absolutely. Sure thing.
Great. Very much want to hear the rest of, or see the rest of that list. And Operator, I believe you have another commenter.
Yes, thank you. Our next comment is from Kim Boyd with Cover My Meds. Please proceed.
Hello, and thank you. Can you hear me okay?
We can. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Task Force Committee, for opening up a dialogue with the public around the initiatives that you're addressing as a Task Force Committee. We are very interested in how the details from this committee will play out for the, you know, the bulk of the health information technology world, especially associated with prior authorization. And my name again is Kim Boyd, and I'm with Cover My Meds. And Cover My Meds is part of McKesson's Prescription Technology Solution, and we're actually one of the fastest growing healthcare tech companies in the U.S. and have been consistently recognized as one of the best places to work in the country. But not only are we industry professionals, but we're also patients ourselves. So we are keenly aware that patients are challenged every day to obtain their needed medications. And our mission as a health IT company is to get patients the medications they need to live healthy lives. And I just wanted to quickly reference our concurrence with a lot of the comments that have been made by the task force committee members around prior authorization and the need to continue to evaluate how to automate, codify that process. Cover My Meds has been very involved in creating those technology solutions in the medication prescription benefit space to automate that process. We've taken what was a very arduous fax process, taking 3 to 5 days to complete and get access for the patient down to near real time, around 8 seconds, by using standards that are available in the industry today. Now, there is still room for improvement, obviously, and again, we're very glad that the task force is looking at ways to improve that by infusing other things like FHIR and API type of technologies. But I do want to concur with task force members who talk about price transparency and real-time benefit tools. As Task Force Committee Member Jocelyn Keegan noted, these tools have been on the market for about a year now, and we do have one of those private tools on the market, and I can tell you that these tools are creating great opportunities to actually mitigate the need for a prior authorization altogether, because the tools will reference that transparency information that patients and providers need to make a thoughtful decision support around the prescription therapy for that patient. And many times we're finding that physicians and they're in dialogue with their patients are actually choosing medications that don't require a PA. So they'll see that a PA is needed. They'll see that the patient is able to afford it based on the transparency structure that's surfaced to them in these tools. And then many times we're going, no, I'm going to go to the alternative because it doesn't require a PA and it's still just as efficient or has efficacy for the patient. So I would encourage Task Force Committee members to still consider that there are other tools out there that can help mitigate requiring a PA altogether, such as real-time benefit tools, and but continue to evaluate how to codify and merge this clinical and administrative functions more thoroughly. And of course, as one of the leaders in the industry, we are more than happy to be a reference or resource for this committee and provide neutral details to what is working in the prior authorization space today as we see it, where it needs to evolve, and of course, around price transparency. And that's it. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Kim. So we are at 4:33, it is fabulous to get public comments. This, I think, is the first meeting we've actually had it, so it's great to get your thoughts and input, and look forward to getting the follow-up from Heather and appreciate the offer from Cover My Meds. Would have ideally spent some time doing some next steps and wrap-up. Cheryl, I think we have to decide on the fly whether we want to ask people to stay a few more minutes or just think about doing our usual debrief after the call and figuring out next steps, and then we can infuse the agenda.
I think to be respectful of people's time, let's do that. But I would ask, you know, we're only, we're not done with this tool yet, so please resolve your issues if you have them with the getting into the Google Doc. Please go in and we'll let you know when Josh has updated the first page, and then we'd appreciate people to go in and make comments to that, and we'll provide some additional instructions for the homework. But this is exactly the kind of input we need in a meeting. I'd much prefer to run out of time. So I think next time we'll continue with where we are. And I want to thank everybody for this great meeting today and their input to date.
Well said. Be well.
Okay. With that, I think we are adjourned, and we'll pick up on kind of the next steps for the group next week on the 21st. So thanks, everyone, for your time today.
Thank you, Lauren.
Bye, everyone.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, everyone.